Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome world-renowned soprano Patricia Rosette. She's the star this year of The Letter at the Santa Fe Opera, and she will be performing An Evening with Patricia Rosette on Sunday, August 9th at 8 o'clock at the Lensic. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, when you prepare for a new role, whether it be The Letter or a brand new opera or a classic opera, how do you do it? What's your process?
My process is doing the rather, get the technical things out of the way. I'll learn the music. You know, if it's in a foreign language, I make sure whatever I don't understand, I do, what is said to me, what I'm saying, that sort of thing. So you learn it. Then you start to sing it in, is what I call, you know, start to vocalize it. And then I'll study it with my teacher. Occasionally I'll coach it. And then you want to sort of allow the process for it to really season and become second nature, because that's the place where you want it to be by the time you get to the staging, so that you're able to really flesh out whatever the character is and whatever the story is, and have it be natural and real.
I was thinking, when you are a young singer, you are learning so much at the same time. You're learning how to be on stage, you're learning vocal technique, you're learning how to act, you're learning the repertoire. Now, as somebody who's been at it for a long time, what's different? What is your learning process like?
Well, as you said correctly, that yes, there's a lot of you're learning as a young singer, and what you learn basically and clearly is you learn how to multitask, and that serves you for your entire career, because you have to be able to have your mind switch gears within seconds all the time. How is it different now? You're just more seasoned. You're more experienced. You're able to know your strengths and your weaknesses and what you need to do. Your methods for learning things, your methods for warming up, your methods for preparing a character have become more solidified. And at the same time, you keep yourself open. I keep saying you. I mean me. I keep myself open to learning new things and developing new ways to understand the character, the situation, or prepare, or vocally, my warm up, things like that. So it's a very dynamic and almost kinetic kind of existence. And your work is never done. That's for sure. You're always in process.
We spoke recently on the show to Terry Teachout and Paul Moravec, talking about your participation in the creation of the opera, The Letter. Let's hear it from your side. What was the nature of your participation in the creation of this opera that you're starring in?
Well, what I love about doing new works, and I have done quite a few at this point, is I love it when the composer and librettist are as willing as Paul and Terry were to collaborate, and I was able to have meetings and conversations with them in which I stated my thoughts and observations about my character. And I always prefaced it. I said, look, I am not the composer. I am not the librettist. I'm not the director, not the conductor. My job is to look at my character and see what that means to me, see what the other characters, how she reflects on the other characters, and to see how real and authentic and fleshed out that character is. And so they were very receptive to my observations on that front. And also in a dramaturgical sense, Leslie didn't have an aria at all while everyone else did. And I said, you don't want to do that for your protagonist for many, many reasons. I said, first of all, we're just going to have a monster on our hands. We don't get to see inside sort of the intimate inner thoughts of what's going on. I said, also, just on a very practical level, you want an acceptable aria from your protagonist for the piece you've composed. So they were very receptive about that, among many other things. And it was such a rich experience.
What's it like to sing it? I'm a relative newcomer to opera, and leaving The Letter, I found that there wasn't really music in my head the way there is leaving, for example, La Traviata.
Right. Well, a lot of new pieces, that might be the statement of a lot of new pieces. There isn't sort of the tune you can't get out of your head. While Paul's music is actually quite tuneful in many spots, it's not the same sort of motivational kind of writing that something like Traviata is, or a lot of Puccini. You know, you hear certain phrases and you know that's Cho-Cho-San, or you hear certain phrases and you know that's Violetta, and it's not quite the same. I don't know if that's a composition style or what, but I mean, I would agree with you. But you know, for me, as having the piece as second nature, you know, there's certainly I have in my mind certain tunes running through my head, but that's after living with it for so many months. And I think the letter succeeds in doing this. You're going in for the impact of the evening. It's not necessarily to, you know, add a song to your iPod. It's really for the impact of the evening and for the entire experience, which is what I love about opera. It's the entirety of the art form and experience that I think is really just magical.
And that's something that has changed in a wonderful way in recent decades, namely that there's so much emphasis on the theatrical part of it. And you are a terrific actress as well.
Well, thank you. That's what drives me. That's what I mean, I jokingly say this. I don't really mean it. I say, well, I don't even like to sing that much. I really like the theater of the experience of singing. I'm not a huge fan of the, as we say in our business, the park and bark kind of operas where you stand there and sing. For me, there always has to be an element of theater and involvement. That's what's interesting to me. We have text. There's a story. There's layering. None of us go through our day without saying something and just meaning simply what those words mean. Everything is always layered and multi-textured in terms of meaning, and so I think it's incumbent upon performing artists to infuse that into the theaters, the theatricality and the drama of the characters and the stories.
Talk a little bit about how you developed the character of Leslie Crosby. She's, you could say, extremely unsympathetic in some way. She's a murderer, but it was a crime of passion, and she's sort of sympathetic, too.
Well, I said this to Paul and Terry from the beginning. I said this to Jonathan Kent, our director. I don't believe she's simply a monster. I think that's just too easy. There, I think, are very few people that are simply monsters when we think about the history of human beings. I'm not saying there aren't some, but I think there's a complexity. There's a reason we're driven to do certain things. And for Leslie, it's this the combination of being completely suppressed and restrained and also just having no control over her passions. And I think that's far more interesting to portray and to tell that story than for her to just be this evil monster that, you know, is dissatisfied with her lover and what he says, so bang, 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 six times. I don't think that's nearly as interesting, and I don't believe it's true. I don't think if you sat down and talk with that person right here, right now, you might initially walk away and say, wow, that woman's a monster. But if you really, really dig into what she's thinking and feeling and who she really is, you might find some aspects that you would feel sympathy or even empathy for. And I think that's always more interesting. We human beings want to reach out to one another. And what's interesting are all the walls we put up. And that's essentially what all these characters are. And the more complex the character in terms of the accessibility, I think the more fun it is to portray, certainly on stage.
And in literature, as in opera, it doesn't really work if the author has moral judgment toward their character. They have to understand the depth of every single character in it, even the so-called villain.
Right, absolutely. I mean, performers, you know, the moral judgment, you know, a lot of performers, you know, doing Butterfly a lot, Pinkertons are always very, very concerned about the audiences booing them and not because of the character, not because of their performance. And I find that interesting. I think when a performer is distracted by how the sympathy they receive from the audience, I don't think their job is on the storytelling. And it really just, you have to trust the storytelling and the truth of it and see where it lands. You know, tried and true productions and pieces that have been done, you generally know what's going to happen and the reception for that character. For a new piece, you don't know. So certainly each performance is very interesting and informative in terms of how the audience responds.
Is there a big difference from one to the next?
Well, I've only done two, and whether notwithstanding, yes, there are some differences. The opening night audience was very enthusiastic. Last night's audience was wildly enthusiastic. We received applause during the piece, and it's, you know, we were talking about the tunefulness of certain moments. So it's not that clear when an aria is finished in a piece that is through composed as many contemporary pieces are. So, but they broke into applause several times after one scene, after scene four, which is an extremely dramatic scene. There was sort of a stifled but an applause trying to happen there. So it was an audience, what I term as an audience that was very close. They were very available and very close. And that's always fun to perform in front of such an audience.
What's it like to sing in English?
I love singing in English. I find it, it's not as easy as singing in Italian in terms of vocalism because we've got some funny vowels that are not necessarily singer-friendly.
Like what?
Well, are like that and, let's see, the it sounds. Those are not singable, you know, whereas you have the pure vowels in the Italian language, for example. So there are some challenges in that front. But I also find singing in English to be incredibly instructive because it is my native language. It shows me and it demonstrates to me exactly how much depth and meaning you can put to the simplest phrase or the simplest word just because you know exactly how it feels and how what it means to you. And it shows, it just reminds you, you have to do that with languages that you speak, but perhaps not fluently like your own language. And I find that always very instructive.
Have you gotten to where you can do that in other languages?
Yes, I hope so. I like to think so. When I do master classes and work with younger singers, I say, okay, you know, you've done your job, you've translated your text here, so you know what you're saying in whatever language, Italian, French, Czech, whatever. You know what you're saying. You know what others are saying to you. That's great. That's not enough. You need to know what it means to you. That is your task as an interpreter of those lines. You can't just know what it means. If we all walked around and only spoke with the meaning of everything our words, we would all sound like robots. So, and fleshing out a character and really making a true moment out of each dramatic situation, you have to really, really, I mean, you have to just digest it. It has to be in your being.
Let's talk about the cabaret evening coming up. What are some of the songs you're going to be singing?
I'll tell you some of the composers I'll be singing. Well, I can tell you some of the songs, but I've been sort of keeping it a surprise. So I'll just tell you the composers, because I'm doing a song by Irving Berlin. I'm doing Cy Coleman, Vernon Duke, Cole Porter, Johnny Mandel, Sondheim, Murray Grand, to just name a few. Some songs will be recognizable. Some, I think, will be greatly unknown by most of the audience members. But they're songs that I just love and love to sing and love the stories. And hopefully will be enjoyed by the audience as much as I enjoy singing them.
Was this the kind of music you were doing before you got into opera?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I was doing a little more jazz-focused songs, but some of these songs I have done in a more of a jazz setting, if you will. But this is basically coming full circle for me. This is, and it feels really good to switch gears and do this, and sort of, it feels like returning home. It reminds me of why and how much I love music.
So you have this opera training. Do you have to put your opera technique aside to sing this kind of music, or how do you sing differently?
No, I don't have to put it aside. In fact, it's not that different. Without getting too technical, my technique is based on a very speech-like technique, and so there are other actions you take in a very vocal, technical sense to make the sound suitable for an operatic treatment, if you will, whereas it's a little more immediate for cabaret and songs of this nature. So they're not at all in conflict. Other than you get no high notes on Sunday, August 9th. None.
No high notes.
No high notes. Lots of low ones, though.
Doing low notes is something you probably don't get to do that much as a soprano.
No, or I don't, and I really dig it. So this is going to be a treat. You know, but it's so funny. The first time I did this, it was, not the first time, but the first time I sort of returned to it was in 2004 at the Lenzic, actually, singing a little bit with the Desert Chorale, and I did, I think, six songs. And I could feel the surprise in the audience. It was palpable, which also made me start perspiring from nerves terribly because I was like, oh my God, they hate me. Because I had mostly people in that audience that only knew my work operatically. And singing my operatic repertoire as opposed to singing my cabaret repertoire they do not sound the same at all. And so I could feel just the energy and the surprise in the audience. They ended up warming up greatly by the time I was on my fourth song or so, but it was very nerve-wracking. And, you know, I've done it enough now where I think people have, you know, become accustomed and know it's incoming low notes, you know, so.
You are totally out as a lesbian. Your partner is also an opera singer. Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll be seeing any opera love stories between two women?
Oh, I've got a secret project that I'm just so eager to get off the ground, but the rights are currently owned by someone else. So there have been a couple. One, Patience and Sarah, I think, was done at New York City Opera. I don't know how long ago. I mean, I wasn't involved with it at all. So I would like to see that. I would. You know what? I like theater and drama because it's recreating the real stuff we all live. And I don't see any reason to exclude that aspect of real life for all of us. So I think, yes, it should be part of our storytelling.
We hope it will. Patricia Rosette, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Dr. Ted Galen Carpenter. He's Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author and editor of numerous books, including Bad Neighbor Policy, Washington's Futile War on Drugs in Latin America, and he will be giving a talk titled Global War on Drugs on Thursday, August 6th from 5 to 7 here in Santa Fe at the Unitarian Universalist Church, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
In your book, you write about the many casualties of the so-called war on drugs, including innocent people being killed, many nonviolent offenders being in prison, corruption, property seizure, the kind of what you might call bending and twisting of the Constitution, and virtually no success in getting illegal drugs off the streets. What was the origin of the war on drugs that started under Nixon in 1971?
It was concern about an upsurge in casual drug use in the United States, primarily marijuana use, but also some other drugs, including LSD and cocaine. President Nixon thought this was very much a moral issue as well as a law and order issue, and so he very much escalated the hostility toward drug use, asked for tougher legislation, and with the international phase of his policy, really began to promote a supply-side campaign against drugs coming into the United States. So that is where the current war on drugs began. We've had a prohibition policy with regard to drugs going back several decades before that, but this represented a big escalation.
And we want to talk about the supply-side concept in just a moment, but this whole moral component that Nixon was dealing with was really part of the counterculture that was the anti-war culture. I mean, there was a real us and them, them being the drug-using, hippie, war-protesting people, and they were trying to stamp out not only drug use, but the culture itself on some level.
Now that's exactly the case, and for Richard Nixon, this was a combination of undesirable traits and behaviors. He did certainly identify drug use with the counterculture, with the people who hated him and his administration and its policies. Hatred that he saw as dislike for fundamental American values. In other words, he saw even casual drug use as profoundly subversive of American values. So this was not just a simple policy issue to him or to many of his advisors.
This idea of cutting off the supply of drugs so that the price would go up and demand would go down, what were the tactics early on used to try to achieve this?
Well, it's been an effort to try to stem the flow of drugs coming into the United States, and it's taken a number of forms, interdicting shipments coming into the U.S. It was fairly clear early on that that wasn't very effective. Even Customs Service officials admitted back in the 1970s that they managed to intercept only about 10% of the drugs coming into the United States. That figure hasn't changed a lot in the past three and a half decades. In addition, the second component, eradication, prevail upon governments in drug source countries to try to eradicate drug crops, whether that's marijuana or coca, the raw ingredient for cocaine, or opium poppies, the raw ingredient for heroin. And the third is essentially trying to bribe those who are at the lowest echelons of the drug trade, namely the farmers who grow the drug crops, trying to persuade them to switch to competing crops or other economic activities. So you have crop substitution programs, you have foreign aid programs for economic development justified in the name of waging the supply-side campaign in the war on drugs. None of those strategies works particularly well then or now.
One of the deep flaws in it, where the cocaine situation was concerned, was that coca, where it's grown in the Andes, was actually, and still is, considered a piece of the culture and a medicinal plant used for tea, used in all sorts of ways. And so trying to get farmers not to grow it was sort of like trying to get Americans not to eat hamburgers.
Yeah, that's a very good comparison, particularly in places like Bolivia and Peru. Chewing coca leaves, brewing coca tea, very much part of the culture, particularly of rural peasants. Beyond that, there is an economic aspect. Growing coca crops can be far more profitable than most competing crops, and coca plants grow almost anywhere. It's a tremendously hardy plant, and it does much better in marginal scrub agricultural terrain where a lot of other crops don't grow very easily. So that effort was running up against some very deep-seated values in a number of those societies.
There has been a long-term problem of the United States wanting to use its power in whatever way it chose in Latin America without regard to either the culture or the governments that be or that were in those places. And you have numerous examples in your book about ways in which the United States just basically stomped on Mexico, Colombia, and the Andean countries.
U.S. officials from the 1970s forward made it very, very clear that defiance with regard to Washington's agenda on the drug war would simply not be tolerated. Any government that attempted to do so would find threats of aid being cut off, of trade sanctions. Officials would find threats to their personal status, that their right to travel to the United States might very well be rescinded, that there would be investigations launched with possible criminal complaints. There was an atmosphere of intimidation with regard to all of these governments, and that put leaders in drug source and drug transiting countries in an almost impossible position, because Washington was in effect demanding that they wage war against significant segments of their own people, against significant segments of their own economy. And they had to placate Washington because it was simply too dangerous not to. On the other hand, they were very much on a tightrope. They could not wage the kind of struggle that Washington desired without irretrievably alienating significant political and economic constituencies in their own countries. So this has been a horribly awkward situation for our neighbors for, again, now better than 3.5 decades.
So then the Nixon era ends, the so-called counterculture and that whole world kind of fades a little bit. It's not that marijuana isn't used, but it's no longer this culture of anti-government hippies that is being targeted. Then Reagan comes in 1981 and takes on the drug war with a whole new vehemence. Why?
Initially, most of his vehemence was rhetorical, and I suspect more political calculation than sincere belief. That changed, though, in 1986 with the death of basketball star Len Bias, who was one of the best players in college basketball, was a very high draft choice of the Boston Celtics. When he died of a cocaine overdose, what you got was a hysterical reaction in the United States, akin to what we saw in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 with regard to the terrorist threat and with regard to security measures. With regard to the bias incident, what we got was a proliferation of very hardline pieces of legislation passed, not only at the federal level, but you see that duplicated in a number of states as well. And internationally, what we see is a renewed emphasis on the supply-side campaign. In fact, in 1986, not long after the Len Bias incident, Ronald Reagan declares drug trafficking to be a national security threat to the United States. Now, that's a very important finding because that authorizes all sorts of actions that would have been at least questionable absent that declaration. And from that point on, you find a renewed emphasis on pressuring all drug source and drug transiting countries into being enthusiastic warriors against the narcotics trade. That impacts primarily early on Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, the main Andean suppliers, but gradually it comes to impact Mexico as well. And when the Mexican drug cartels really begin to displace the Colombian drug cartels during the years of this decade as the primary players in the international drug trade, that's when we see an upsurge not only of the power of the cartels generally in Mexico, but what we've seen most recently, a huge upsurge in violence in that country.
We're talking to Dr. Ted Galen Carpenter of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. One of the things that is very significant about that time is the militarization of the war on drugs and the questionable implications of that for the U.S. Constitution. Can you talk about that?
Certainly the military was given a larger role in anti-drug efforts than it ever had before. We see that applied primarily in trying to interdict drug supplies coming into the United States. So the military begins to play a role on the border. Also, we find the military involved in joint operations in places like Colombia, primarily training operations for anti-drug forces in host countries like Colombia. But the military begins to regard the war on drugs as one of its missions. It's not a tremendously high priority mission during this period, but it's there. It's very much in the background. It's part of the mix that goes into the military's budgets and missions. And that has faded somewhat in the last number of years, but it's in some ways a permanent part of the policy environment now. It's not likely to disappear entirely, absent a radical change in our entire drug policy internationally and domestically.
Under Ronald Reagan, there was a great deal of military action in Central America, in Nicaragua and Honduras and El Salvador and so on, the effort being to stamp out leftist movements there, partly as a kind of proxy war against the Soviet Union and also for economic reasons to protect U.S. Corporate interests there. People, we know a lot about this. In Colombia, in other places that weren't per se Cold War interests on the part of the United States, what kind of overlap did you see between stamping out leftist movements and the drug war?
Those interests begin to converge, not only in Colombia, but you start to see it in a few other countries as well. In Peru, for example, the worry about the Maoist shining path, guerrillas, and the threat that they pose to the Peruvian government. The Shining Path also had a de facto alliance with a lot of the coca farmers. So U.S. aid to Peru during the 1980s and into the 1990s is focused on both missions, trying to weaken the Shining Path, but also to significantly dampen the drug trade. The problem there, and we see it emerge as a dilemma in Colombia as well later on, is that those goals are almost mutually exclusive. The coca farmers made common cause with the Shining Path precisely because the Peruvian government was putting so much pressure on them and their source of livelihood. In the early 1990s, the U.S. finally backed off from the anti-drug goal, basically looking the other way as the government of Alberto Fujimori concentrated on weakening the power and appeal of the Shining Path and very much tolerating drug crop cultivation by farmers in Bolivia. And so we finally saw those two goals separated. In Colombia, on the other hand, during the 1990s and really continuing almost to the present day, the U.S. combined the goal of trying to combat the left-wing insurgency represented primarily by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, and drug trafficking. And again, U.S. policymakers often conflated the two, even though a lot of right-wing paramilitary organizations were also involved in the drug trade. That muddied the situation a great deal. But the U.S. saw the Plan Colombia, for example, the multi-billion dollar aid program that the Clinton administration began in 2000, as a means to both weaken the FARC and the leftist insurgency in general, and to decrease the amount of drugs coming out of Colombia. Looking back on that aid program, which I think is amounted to well over $5.5 billion over this decade, it seems to have achieved some success in helping to weaken the FARC. It has achieved virtually no success in stemming the supply of drugs coming out of Colombia.
You compare drug prohibition to alcohol prohibition with the black markets and the cartels, which are basically gigantic international mafias of various kinds. And I think you can also talk about, in that regard, the actual use at home, alcohol abuse versus alcohol use, drug abuse versus drug use. You certainly think of drug prohibition in that way. How is it similar to and how is it different from the alcohol prohibition that we have known early in the last century of this nation?
There are two differences with regard to the current prohibitionist system and the prohibition of alcohol. First of all, even the most popular recreational drug, marijuana, is not as pervasive in the culture as alcohol was at the time of prohibition. Nevertheless, you do have a lot of users out there, and they show almost no respect for a law that just tramples on their right of personal behavior. The other thing is a big difference in the prohibition laws. Under alcohol prohibition, bootleggers were guilty of committing a criminal act, but people who consumed alcohol, even though it was illegal, were not criminally prosecuted. Of course, with the current drug laws, both users and traffickers are criminally prosecuted. So our current prohibitionist system is even harsher and more unenlightened than the version in the 1920s and early 1930s with regard to alcohol.
And it also draws virtually no distinction between users and abusers.
That's absolutely correct. It's very much the same mentality that gets us to the similarities. The notion that one could be a casual user of even a relatively mild drug like marijuana is anathema to drug warriors in the United States. To them, everything is drug abuse if an illegal drug is used, no matter how mild the drug, no matter how infrequently an individual might use it. And that is increasingly lacking credibility with millions of Americans. You mentioned the counterculture back in the 1960s and 1970s, and I think that was the image of the typical drug user, even the typical marijuana user. The image of the typical marijuana user today might be Michael Phelps. I mean, very much an establishment figure. That caricature of drug users is becoming even less relevant than it was in the past. The other similarity is both alcohol prohibition and the current prohibition system defy the basic laws of economics. Namely, if you have strong demand for a product or service, it's absolute certainty that entrepreneurs will rise to satisfy that demand. When you make the product or service illegal, you guarantee that the suppliers will be primarily criminal elements and, given the nature of the situation, violence-prone criminal elements. So prohibition does not solve the problem. It does not eliminate a product. It simply drives it underground with all sorts of terrible side effects.
We're talking to Dr. Ted Galen Carpenter of the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. So another point that I think is very important to make that you bring out in your book is that the cause of drug-related crimes, violent crimes, burglary, all sorts of things involving harm to people and their property is not caused, even if it's related to drugs, it's not caused by drug use itself. It's caused by the drug prohibition laws.
That's true in most of the cases. I would never say that there aren't crimes that are committed by people who are just high, completely out of control because they're using drugs, just as there are crimes committed by people who are wildly drunk. But a majority of the crimes that involve drug users fall into two categories. Either they are crimes involved in the mere possession or sale of drugs, or they are crimes committed by obsessive drug users trying to raise enough money to support their habit, a habit that is much more expensive under the prohibition system than it would be if we had a legalized system and simply treated obsessive drug use or addiction as the public health problem that it really is, rather than the criminal justice problem that our policy has made it.
I think there's a metaphor problem going on, which is that when you frame something as a war, getting people to see it as a public health problem, it's a pretty big step.
That's very much the case, and I wish that there was a ban on the use of the word war to describe any other public policy. War ought to be confined to true armed combat. We can't have wars on poverty, wars on cancer, or wars on drugs. And it's a dangerous metaphor because it tends to lead to a highly intolerant, almost hysterical mentality in the country. And that invariably leads to very bad policy and very bad outcomes for people who are unlucky enough to run afoul of that policy. And that's certainly what's happened in the United States. We have filled our prisons with small-time drug offenders, mainly people who engage in small-scale sales of drugs. And we even have people who were not involved in sales but were involved in possession and use who now have criminal records, criminal convictions, even if they didn't serve jail time. One wonders how many lives that may have had considerable potential have been blighted because of that kind of criminal stigma. One wonders, for example, about a certain gentleman named Barack Obama who admits that he used illegal drugs in his youth. What would have happened to his future if he had been one of the unlucky ones to run afoul of the drug laws? Like so many others have, it's almost like a lottery. But had he been one of the unlucky ones, he definitely would not be president of the United States today. I bet he wouldn't have been able to go to Harvard Law School, for that matter.
Right.
And that kind of terrible consequence has been repeated hundreds of thousands of times across this country over the years.
We spoke recently on this program to a retired police officer who's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, and he said that he was speaking once with a politician off the record, behind closed doors, who said, you know, I agree with everything you're saying about ending drug prohibition, but if I run on that platform, I could be beaten by a three-legged deaf dog.
I've had similar conversations with congressional staffers, and in one case, even a member of Congress who privately said that the drug laws make no sense. But as one of them put it, my boss is not going to be the first one to stick his head above the trench and charge the machine guns of the drug war establishment. He'll wait for somebody else to do that, and if that person survives, then, and only then, might he begin to take action. I suspect there is a surprising amount of covert support out there, even within the political hierarchy, for abandoning this utterly failed policy. But no one wants to be the first one to be out there taking that risk. Once that logjam breaks, I think we might be surprised at just how fast the laws and the policies change.
It does seem like such a horrible policy in terms of what has resulted in Colombia and what has resulted in Mexico, which is really, in many places now, a dangerous country to visit, not so much because of swine flu, but because of the drug cartels and the violence surrounding them.
It certainly has become a very bad situation. As I mentioned earlier, the Mexican cartels have gradually replaced the Colombian cartels as the dominant player in the international drug trade. And several of the cartels in Mexico are engaged in very vicious turf battles, and they're also engaged in a battle against the Calderon government. President Felipe Calderon has adopted almost precisely the kind of policy the U.S. had been pushing on Mexican administrations for decades, namely to wage a robust campaign against the drug traffickers. And in Calderon's case, he decided to make the army the lead agency. Well, this has been less than successful, and I'm being charitable with that assessment. It has led to a massive upsurge in violence, and today there are a number of areas in Mexico where it is profoundly unsafe to venture, particularly in the northern border cities of Mexico. But the violence is spreading beyond that, and more and more innocent people are at risk because of the violence taking place in that country.
If illegal drugs were to be legalized and regulated, as you advocate, how would that affect the drug cartels? What would happen if it were just legalized in the United States, no place else?
Well, first of all, if it were legalized in the United States, I don't think it would be very long before you would see other dominoes topple. A good many countries embrace the prohibition strategy largely because the United States insists on it, and again, it's rather dangerous to defy the wishes of the U.S. government. If the U.S. did a 180-degree turn and got rid of prohibition, I think you'd see the global prohibition policy erode rather quickly. What it would do to the cartels, if we legalized all drugs, it would be a massive defunding. About 90% of the retail price of drugs is due to the black market premium, the risk factor caused by prohibition. Most of that 90% flows into the coffers of the big cartels, not the farmers growing the crops and so on, or the small-time dealers on the streets of America. Even if the U.S. Legalized marijuana, that would reduce the revenue flow to the Mexican drug cartels by about 50 to 55%. It would be a very, very big blow to their fortunes. And if we want to weaken the clout of the cartels, weaken the threat that they now pose to the stability of Mexico, to the authority of the Mexican government, that would be the most constructive step that we could take.
You will be here very soon, actually Thursday, August 6th, talking about the global war on drugs. We haven't gotten into the Middle East, and we don't really have time to talk about that, but is that something that you're going to address when you're here in Santa Fe?
I will touch on the drug war in Afghanistan, which is tremendously complicating our overall objective in that country, namely to defeat the radical Islamist terrorists in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. It does undermine that objective by anti-narcotics measures really antagonizing Afghan farmers and some regional political players that, to this point at least, support the Karzai government in Kabul.
Because, I mean, what the United States is trying to do is make allies there, and when you're doing this poppy eradication program, you're making enemies instead.
Exactly. We are providing the perfect recruitment tool for the Taliban and al-Qaeda. To its credit, the Obama administration seems to be beginning to grasp that point. There was a story leaked just earlier this week that the Obama administration seems to be wanting to recalibrate the anti-drug effort in Afghanistan and downplay it, not give it the kind of prominence that it has had in recent years.
The word that you used, anti-drug hysteria, there are emotional and irrational overtones to that. Certainly it's understandable in the context of Richard Nixon being threatened by this counterculture in the 1960s and 70s. Does that hysteria still really exist? And if so, what's driving it?
It's faded, certainly, from what it was in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But it's still there in certain segments of American society. You see it with the commercials from the Partnership for a Drug-Free America and other anti-drug groups that portray even casual marijuana use as virtually guaranteeing that kids will become zombies and total losers. That's not a rational argument, and it's certainly not supported by the facts. But what we have seen in recent years is more flexibility on the part of a lot of Americans. The passage of medical marijuana laws in a variety of states
including New Mexico.
Correct. And that is a sign that you may have a major segment of the public that remains somewhat nervous about drug use and reluctant to embrace legalization, but they're not using the Lady Macbeth out damn spot attitude toward drug use anymore. And I think that's growing. We've already seen a proposal from a state senator in California to legalize drugs and regulate and tax it. And Governor Schwarzenegger said, well, I think that ought to be seriously discussed and debated. He didn't just rule it out. You had a former governor in New Mexico, of course, that openly advocated drug legalization. So I think the tide is beginning to turn, but there are unfortunately a lot of vested interests now in maintaining the current drug policy. The drug war itself has become a more than $40 billion a year nexus of interest in the United States. And that kind of lobby is awfully hard to overcome.
There is, in the United States, although I think it's shifting slowly, still a kind of vestigial Puritanism that is very suspicious of anything that is pleasurable. And certainly many illegal drugs and legal drugs like alcohol are nothing if not pleasurable. Do you think that that plays some role in the attitudes against drugs?
It may very well be an underlying psychological factor. I think it's perhaps a bit more fear of loss of control, that when people use drugs, they get out of control, and therefore that leads to all sorts of unpredictable outcomes in society and behavior that at least conservative types regard as antisocial. That attitude, I think, is also beginning to fade, but that is something that has very deep historical roots in America. That certainly was an underlying factor with alcohol prohibition. There's no question about that, that the traditional Protestant elements in the United States were the strongest supporters of prohibition. That was not coincidental.
Dr. Ted Galen Carpenter is Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the book Bad Neighbor Policy, Washington's Futile War on Drugs in Latin America. And his talk here in Santa Fe on Thursday, August 6th, will be titled Global War on Drugs. It's from 5 to 7 at the Unitarian Universalist Church, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. You can find them at sfcir.org or call 505-982-4931. Are you going to be doing a question and answer period with the folks who attend?
Oh, yes. That is always part of any presentation I make. I try to leave enough time for quite a number of questions from the audience.
Well, Dr. Carpenter, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.